Coming up on Weekend America.
This weekend, there are lots of open houses and lots of denial.
Even though they know the prices are falling, their home is special. And it's somehow exempt from the market. And every seller's home is special, it turns out.
Go ahead, realtors. Let it all out. I'm Bill Radke. Also this hour, what do you do when dad stops behaving like dad?
Well, I've been getting two of these deep tissue massages a day, which is absolutely... I don't like massages, but these are acupressure things. I never knew you had more of these many pressure points.
And in Atlanta this weekend, I'm sorry, Miss Jackson, but Outkast is embracing classical dance.
Because you have, you know, the sophistication of the ballet with the funk of me and my band, you know what I'm saying, what we do. As long as nobody don't kick me in the face with a tutu shoe.
I don't think they're technically called tutu shoes, but we'll give you the whole story after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to the weekend. Desiree Cooper is away. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. A lot of people think ballet is old-fashioned, it's outdated, it's dull. If only the dancers would shake it in the manner of, say, I don't know, a Polaroid picture. Later this hour, Outkast meets ballet this weekend in Atlanta. Tell me, whose music would you like to see turned into a ballet?
I would totally like to see a ballet based on the works of Ozzy Osbourne.
I'm a big fan of Pink Floyd, actually.
It would be interesting to see Madonna.
Something by Queen. It's just very epic.
I would like to see Jay-Z with Beyoncé and Mary J. Blige do a ballet.
I would like to see Metallica turn into a ballet. I think it would be more action-packed. I saw Nutcracker and over the holidays, and they should have passed out pillows at the door. It was a little too boring for me.
Yeah, sure. Interesting. Exit Sugar Plum Fairy, enter Sandman. I like it. Those voices came from Cincinnati, New Orleans, Chicago, Nashville, and Atlanta. Well, thanks for joining us this hour. It is a weekend of mixed feelings for our nation's soldiers and their families. General David Petraeus testified to Congress this week, and President Bush made announcement about military strategy. On the one hand, the general and president say the surge is working, violence is down in Iraq, and tours for soldiers will be shortened from 15 months to 12. On the other hand, there will be no further troop reductions for the foreseeable future. As April is National Poetry Month, we thought we would take a look at the war through poetry today, starting with war veteran and poet Brian Turner. Brian is the author of Hear Bullet, a book of poems about his time in Iraq. He wrote the poem Cole's Guitar on his last night in Iraq. It's a poem about coming home.
It's the sound from the aid station that wakes me. Thin steel from Doc Cole's six-string. A 4 a.m. sound of sour whiskey, heroin and sex and dying. That's the sound I'm hearing now. Slow as smoke from a factory in Pittsburgh. Slow as a needle in the vein. Slow as steam off the bath or a lover with only the blues to sing. I'm hearing America now. I'm hearing Jake breaks off the grapevine, county highways with wheat shocks and Indian summer grass whispering, foghorns under the Golden Gate Bridge, Ella Fitzgerald from a fourth-floor window in Birmingham, the handles of a suitcase swinging on the downbeat of a man's footsteps walking out from a greyhound in Santa Fe. I'm in Wyoming. I'm in New York. I'm leaning in to kiss a woman in the cornfields down by the river. I'm with children drawing portraits in the sand, old men watching fireflies the way Muhammad Ali lay on the canvas and dreamed. That's what I'm hearing, the wind on the redwood coast, old as the ocean and hushed by sheets of fallen snow. Palm mute the strings, Doc. Strum that song until I can see the breath on a bus window, the faces of strangers in the rain, my own hands tracing the features of every one of them, the way ghosts might visit the ones they love, as I am now, listening to America, touching the cold glass.
Brian Turner reading his poem Cole's Guitar from his book Hear Bullet. Mickey Caesar was a staff sergeant in the Army Reserves in Kuwait. He's the author of the book Vanishing Point. Here he is reading his poem Burning in Asalia.
Shadows stand straight in the sand. An idiot breeze has caught hold of the phantoms, and bolts strike back when steel is surprised by the call of the Muzzahing. And where does the wheat-colored girl fit in when sparrows wilt in the heat? She is tending an oven in an open kitchen on the other side of the world. Here, steel and sand reach astonishing temperatures, and soldiers simmer in a slow broiling sun.
I'm trying to picture you writing poetry in the Middle East. Will you describe such a scene for us? What was happening?
I was stationed in the Udari Desert, and on the Department of Defense country maps, some areas are labeled urban, agricultural, industrial. The area I was at was labeled simply wasteland.
Wow.
It was a square mile cut out of the desert behind 12-foot berms. And I would oftentimes go to what was called downtown of the camp. It was a small area of about 7 tiny trailers that had, there was actually a small Burger King and a small Pizza Hut. And I would sit out in front of the green beans coffee trailer in 130-degree heat in the sun and write a poem while the sand was landing on the paper.
What do you want your readers to think when you write a poem that's sparked by something as small to us, big to you, as your longing? Do you want us to make bigger connections?
I would like people to make bigger connections, but what I want to accomplish mostly is for people to understand that the soldiers that they send to war are real people with real feelings. They're not G.I. Joes come straight out of the box. That every decision made politically impacts families. The number of suicides, divorces, the lingering emotional problems that a good percentage of soldiers will suffer, these kinds of damages just aren't really seen in the general population.
Mickey, thanks for spending this time with us.
Oh, you're quite welcome, Bill. Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke. If you drive around almost any neighborhood this weekend, you'll see brightly colored signs with arrows pointing you toward open houses. Maybe you'll look at a few homes just out of curiosity. This is weekend recreation for you, but it is a day at the office for the real estate agent putting that house on the market. And lately, it's an unnerving work environment. Prices are falling, sales are slow. Weekend America's John Moe went to some open houses in the Twin Cities to find out how realtors are adapting.
In a cozy three-bedroom in West St. Paul, Bill Fairbanks is running an open house.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Hi, I'm Bill.
Judy.
Hey, Judy, nice to meet you.
Larry, nice to meet you, Larry.
We got some other ones already?
Yeah.
Went through?
A few years ago, Bill would lead off one of these chats by talking up the house, brag about the yard, point out the kitchen. Now, given the climate of falling prices, rising foreclosures, and recession, he talks globally.
First thing I do is in starting a conversation with them is it's not about that house there or about any specific property, but more about the industry overview, you know, what's going on, where their apprehensions may be in relation to friends or relatives that they've heard things from.
It's a buyer's market, and buyers are doted upon. Calm them down, earn their trust, then get to the house later. As for sellers, they have work to do.
We'll go out and look at some homes in some areas that they may want to purchase within so that they're seeing it from a buyer's perspective instead of seeing it from their seller's perspective. And then we'll even role play it and we'll come to their houses if we're a buyer looking. What do you guys see? Well, no, I think our house is great. No, let's look through the eyes that we just talked about and that we were just out doing.
You're kind of good cop with the buyers and you're bad cop with the sellers, aren't you?
Yeah, that actually is, that would be a good way to put it.
20 miles away in the posh suburb of Eden Prairie, Julie Tronis is showing a home priced at $899,900, down from $950,000. She, too, makes her sellers, even the well-heeled ones, hit the pavement and tour houses as if they were buyers. It's tough love, but it's a tough market.
They're savvy buyers. They want the home to be ready to move into, and sometimes they even aren't very interested if the paint color isn't what they're looking for, which seems very trite to us, but that's kind of where they're coming from.
Julie says prices are down. So are sales. Meanwhile, she's spending more on marketing and she's skipping vacations.
It takes more time, energy, and money to sell your listings than it did a few years ago.
People are working harder for those smaller numbers.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
Up in Minneapolis, Cody Lowry relaxes on a couch after a three-hour open house.
Lots of people want to buy. I was inundated today. But they all, of course, would prefer to buy at the bottom. But nobody knows where the bottom is until it's on its way up.
Even with the falling national numbers, some neighborhoods, like the one Cody's in, are actually doing okay. But in this market, there's more psychology than math.
If you put their home on the market, even though they know the prices are falling, their home is special, and they live in it, and it's somehow exempt from the market because what they did to it was special. And every seller's home is special, it turns out.
Lowry regularly employs a squadron of staging consultants, plumbers, carpenters, anyone who can make the house stand out.
Like, we staged this house, and the woman that I used for this came up with a 7-page, single-spaced set of directions on what the sellers should do, where to put the furniture. And her deal is anything smaller than your fist gets put away.
As news on real estate seems to get ever bleaker, agents are buckling down and getting more creative. They have to make those sales so they can pay their own mortgages. Cody Lowry recalls the lengths he recently went to in order to land a sale.
The stagers felt that there was some friction or some bad vibes in the house. So they brought this woman in who burned sage, and she makes certain recommendations. In this house, there had to be a green candle in the bedroom. I mean, this sounds crazy, but I got to tell you, we're having showings like crazy on this house. And in another one, she insisted on having red tulips near the front door. And apparently, I mean, I don't know, we'll see if it works.
In Minneapolis, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Green candles, red tulips, and sage. If you'd like some tips for making your home look professionally staged, we have before and after photos of how the pros do it. Come take a look at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
You might disapprove of our next story. The man who tells it certainly did. Coming up, what do you do when your father deserves a good talking to? This is Weekend America. Thank you. This is Weekend America. Desiree Cooper will be back next week. I'm Bill Radke. This weekend, a 60-year-old American named Paul Maxson is relaxing on a beach in southern Thailand. His son David, who lives in New York, is still trying to figure out exactly what his dad is doing there. David brings us their story.
A couple of months ago, my dad sent the family an email with the following passage. Thailand travel note. On the 20th, I travel on a 3-to-4-city 10-day matrimonial tour. Older monogamous men, so typical in the U.S., are popular with Asian women. Travel note seemed like a bit of an understatement. This was unnerving, not least because I felt like my dad was looking past some ominous signs that the tour was not on the up and up. Take the tour's website. Except for the subject matter, it looked like a project from a late 90s high school computer class and featured grainy pictures of young Asian women against a gaudy pink background. I felt pretty confident that he would get his money taken, or end up an unwitting participant in Thailand's notorious sex trade, or worse. I found the trip a little embarrassing, too. For example, how was I supposed to tell the Asian American woman I'm dating about it? She said she hoped people didn't think we met that way. Hey, Dad.
Hey, son.
I called my dad a few hours before he left for Thailand to see what was compelling him to do what, in my mind, looked like a modern twist on the mail-order bride.
Well, turning 60,
Last fall, he turned 60, just days after his own father died. I knew that was tough for him. Maybe that had something to do with this trip.
Yeah, 11 days, or no, within 2 weeks of your father dying, yes, absolutely.
Now, my dad is no slouch. He built a successful business from the ground up and was able to retire early. Stays in pretty good shape, doesn't drink or smoke, and generally has a lot going for him. But he'd be the first to tell you that stability in relationships has been elusive. He's dated a lot. He's even been engaged a number of times since he and my mom split about 20 years ago. And since Grandpa died last fall, he seems more determined than ever to find someone to grow old with. I decided to call and check up on him while he was in Thailand, make sure he wasn't getting into something sinister. He explained how the tour worked. It was organized by an American man and his Malaysian wife. Every day they set up sort of blind dates, with women interested in marrying Western men. The first time I got him on the phone, he already had a prospect.
One of them is really, you know, really, a really nice, nice, down-to-earth girl.
What's her name?
Tuk Ta. Yeah, I may have to change that. I've got to refer to my notes on that.
Did you get that? He needs to check his notes. So what do you do when you're not meeting with,
Well, I've been getting two of these, deep tissue massages a day, which is absolutely... I don't like massages, but these are acupressure things. I never knew you had many pressure points.
I guess I didn't see the harm in him getting a little attention and enjoying a few massages. He assured me they were the innocent variety. But the next time we spoke, he had a surprise.
I think I'm engaged.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
How exactly you can think you're engaged was not clear to me. And this wasn't even the same woman, the one whose name he had trouble with. I was happy to know the tour wasn't what I thought it might be, a thinly veiled prostitution ring. But now, I was faced with a threat that it was exactly what it claimed to be. An efficient, but unromantic matchmaking machine. I wanted my dad to slow down a little bit.
Why don't you just wait? Why don't you, and if you're so sure about it.
Marry her, no.
Why would you get engaged, then?
So she knows I'm serious.
There's no other way for her to know you're serious?
Talk is cheap. And all I have to do is call up the engagement saying...
I mean, you're already, like, verbally, like, out loud considering calling off the engagement? I mean, you're saying that there's an out or whatever, I mean...
There always is.
Well, I mean, what would that do to her, though? I mean, what would that do to her family and stuff?
I mean, and on the basis of you saying that to me, and I thank you for saying that, I'm going to say that to her. What if we find out we're not compatible? What if I find that, you know, blah, blah, blah?
I'd heard about the role reversal that takes place as parents age, when the child slowly comes to take care of his parents, but I never expected it to happen on a long-distance phone call, trying to convince my dad not to marry a stranger he'd met on a matrimonial tour.
Okay, Dad, take care. Have fun. We'll talk soon, okay?
Okay. I'll be careful, and thank you. You know, keep reminding me.
All right.
You're helping me.
I was glad to see him being more circumspect. I felt a little more comfortable leaving him alone for a while after that. And by the time we spoke again, about a week later, the engagement was off. I guess she wasn't ready, for one thing.
And certain things happened, like, you know, and looking back, we all went bowling, and she didn't bowl, and I thought, you know, what the hell, you know? I asked her if she wanted to play pool, and it sounds like she just doesn't do anything. And she doesn't dance.
Soon enough, my dad had a crush on his masseuse, then a woman with three children. The next time I talked to my dad, I told him the whole thing just seemed so frantic.
Well, I've had people say, Paul, you try so hard. Finally, it dawned on me, well, what in the hell is the alternative? You know, a life of an abysmal life leading to death, or you just keep trying with, you know, very mixed success sometimes.
When I first saw the gaudy pink website for the Thai matrimonial tour, it never occurred to me that it was selling an antidote for an abysmal life leading to death. But as my dad and I talked, I realized his desire to go to Asia and find a wife was part of something bigger. And that was what scared me most. Not the fact that he was on some desperate transcontinental quest to find a wife, but the fact that he's starting to let the idea of death dictate his actions in life. It's like he's already starting to die, or at least preparing for it, and I want to stop him. So, my dad's mortality is driving us both in a way.
So how much longer do you have over there?
Till I go home, if ever.
Yeah?
Yeah, I might just pay somebody to pack me up and sell my stuff.
However long he stays in Thailand, I'll keep checking up on him. The phone calls have become a way for us to talk about this thing that scares us both. This thing we'll both have to face someday. In New York, I'm David Maxim for Weekend America.
There are a lot of difficult issues around international matchmaking and so-called matrimonial tours in any country, risks of exploitation, cultural stereotyping. Why would Americans feel compelled to go to another country to look for romance? Why would a Thai woman want to move halfway around the world to marry a Western man? We'd like to know what you think about this story. Is it ever okay to go on a tour like this? And what would you have done in David's position? If you have thoughts or experiences of your own, send them our way. You can see photos of Paul on his Thailand trip and links to all of this week's stories, and you can share your own story when you spend time with us at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
You don't spend enough time with your kids, you feel guilty, so you include them in your adult decision-making. And the effect is coming up on Weekend America. Thank you. This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke. And this is a wood thrush. You can find it in the eastern United States, mostly in the deep woods. You can spot it by its spots. Now, this is the dark-eyed junco. A musical trill is how birders describe its song. These melodies and other sounds of nature make up a weekend soundtrack for one of our listeners, Hans Petruschka. See, this is the part of the show where we play your weekend soundtrack, usually the song that you return to over and over when you're off the clock. Well, Hans listens to us in Kirtland, Ohio, and he told us his weekend soundtrack comes to him unplugged when he's on long walks near his home. Hans, why are the sounds of nature the soundtrack to your weekend?
It's peaceful, and it reminds me of what a beautiful place I live in, and I'm very fortunate to live in this place. And what's amazing about it is that I live just 18 miles from downtown Cleveland, which is a major metropolitan area, yet I'm fortunate to have a 370-acre forest preserve in my backyard, and it's just very nice to be able to, and it's really a privilege to live in such a place.
Tell us about this forest preserve. What does it look like? What's there?
Let's go to one of my favorite places, which is Stebbins Gulch. It's got this beautiful, pristine stream that runs down through it, and it cuts through the different rock layers. And the forest in the springtime and summer is beautiful and lush and green. And you're down low, and so you're not hearing the sounds of cars or tires on the road, and you're not hearing the sound of any sorts of machines, and it's quiet, and it takes a little while to get used to that and to recalibrate yourself. You don't have to shout over the noise of the machines. You just can whisper, and people can hear you, and you need to pay attention with all of your senses and not just with your eyes, and by letting nature into your ears, you start to appreciate it that much more.
What song does nature sing to you? What are those sounds?
It's really a symphony. I mean, one of the things is I don't necessarily need the human voice. And so those songs of those birds kind of fill the environment. And, you know, I think about a couple things. Like down in some of the ravines and valleys, there's this bird called a winter wren. And this is just a tiny little bird, you know, just a few inches long. And when you're in a valley or a ravine and this bird starts to sing, it fills the whole valley with its song. And it's just musical and beautiful, and it just takes your breath away. There's also the sounds of the leaves in the trees, the wind in the trees, and the running water, because we have lots of streams that run through the ravines and valleys. And so you hear that, and it all kind of combines.
Hans, every other one of our listeners who has shared a weekend soundtrack has shared recorded music. Why is the sound of nature so much more vital to you?
Well, it's never the same. Start at 6 in the morning, and then by 9 in the morning, the sounds have changed completely. And it evokes the feelings that I want most in my life outside of feelings like, you know, love and comfort. But in terms of being comfortable with my surroundings, the sounds of nature are what make me feel the best.
Hans, this has been a fantastic addition to our weekend soundtrack series. Thank you.
You're welcome, Bill. It was good talking with you.
Hans Petruschka in Kirtland, Ohio. He took some gorgeous photos of his backyard paradise, so you can get the visual, too, at weekendamerica.org. Special thanks to Nature Sound recordist Martin Stewart for letting us use his work. So what about you? What song is the soundtrack to your weekend, or what sound, should I say, is the soundtrack to your weekend? Let us know at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Des Cooper is away this weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. Today, Sherry Connett is sensing spring at home. The fresh wind, the scent of frost coming out of the ground, the beginnings of needle and thread grass peeking out of the dirt, baby calves running around with their tails stuck straight out. Home for Sherry is central Nebraska. She grew up on a ranch in the rural western part of the state, and she remembers when she went away for college longing for springtime at home.
The year I graduated from high school, my parents divorced, and I lived with my mom. And then after I graduated, I went to Laramie, Wyoming, to school. And Laramie is so different from Nebraska. It was one reason I picked it was because it was small. I didn't want to go to Lincoln, where I consider it's a big town. I mean, I grew up 30 miles from town, so living in any size of a town was an adjustment for me. And I was living on the eighth floor of a skyscraper for Wyoming. And it was completely different, and it was still cold and snowy, and I was in town, and there was a lot of concrete, and I was homesick and heartsick. I missed the ranch more than probably I missed my family, but I missed my parents being together, too. And I was watching my lifelong dream of living where I grew up fade away. Spring comes later to Laramie, and I was a long ways from cows and baby calves to watch, and there aren't meadowlarks in town, and it didn't smell like spring yet, I guess, but it felt like it should be spring because it would have been spring back home. I had a classmate named Pete, and he invited me and my roommate to go to his place and listen to some music and study, and he put in a tape, and it was Ian Tyson, and he was singing this song called Springtime, and he talks about people taking care of the cattle in the spring and the baby calves and bald eagles, and it just, I started listening to that, and I just started crying, and I cried, and I cried, and I pretty much melted.
Bald eagles back in the cottonwood tree. The old brown hills are just about bare. Springtime sighing all along the creek. Magpies ganging up everywhere.
And I cried for two whole songs, and he's just sitting there holding me, thinking to himself probably, what have I got myself into?
Gary's pulling calves at the old stampede. We made it through another on the northern range. Lonnie's pulling calves at the top of the world. We made it through another on the northern range.
I liked his voice, and what he sang about was what he was living, and it was what I had grown up in, and he was talking to my heart. After winter, things are bare and brown, and you're looking for anything that means spring, and along the creek, it's getting green, and the water's running because of the snow melt, and the eagles are back. Everything about it just spoke to my heart. Today, I live, it's been 18 years, and I live on an acreage outside of Chapman, Nebraska. We've got a few cows and a horse. My husband also came from a ranch, and we're getting baby calves now, and they're running around and romping and having playing games and stuff. And I'm looking forward to the frost coming out of the ground and hearing the first meadowlark.
Bald eagles back in the cottonwood.
It'll be fun to take the kids out there this spring and catch frogs and get muddy.
Springtime sighing all along the creek. Magpies ganging up everywhere. Sunshine's warm on the eastern.
This weekend, Sherry Connett is taking care of her calves at her home outside of Chapman, Nebraska. To this day, she says that Ian Tyson song brings a lump to her throat. You can see Sherry's Nebraska ranch in the springtime and Sherry branding a cow when you come home to weekendamerica.org.
Jeans pulling calves at the horseshoe bar. We made it through another on the north.
This is Weekend America. America is waiting to see how the Democratic Party's superdelegates will make up their minds and pick a candidate. And some superdelegates have said that a major factor in their decision will be the opinion of their children. And it doesn't stop with candidates. Kids are helping drive other issues, too. The environmental movement, for example, benefits from young people badgering their parents to go green. And if kids are influential on issues, they're probably pretty good at getting the stuff they want. We asked a couple of high school students how they get their way with their parents.
Our house, we just remodeled it like a couple years ago, maybe three, and I persuaded them into picking the color. I wanted the color pistachio green. I kept on telling them, so what color are we going to paint it? And then they would be like, oh, yellow. And I'll be like, oh, I don't like, oh, the yellow's so ugly and no one's going to like it. We're going to look like the brightest house down the block, until my mom finally was like, you're right, it's going to look ugly. So then she got the green that I liked.
I tend to do well in school and everything, so I kind of use that as my way of getting what I want. Because, you know, like when I'm going out or to a party or something, I'll ask my parents, and then they might be hesitant and say no, but then, you know, they'll think about that I'm a good kid and I do, like, everything in school that I need to. So they kind of feel bad by, like, not letting me have, like, these privileges and everything. So that's how I basically get my way.
Mm-hmm. Now, being a new parent myself, I am learning the allure of a child's approval. It's natural to want to please your kids and empower them as they get older. But are we giving our kids too much power? Julie Ross has some ideas about this. She is a family therapist and a parent herself. Julie, welcome to Weekend America.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Why is the modern child so influential?
I think there's probably a number of reasons. One, I think, has to do with exposure. Kids today are exposed to so much more than, say, if you rolled back time to the 50s. I also think that parents are increasingly distracted. Parents are often on their mobile phones. They are using the computer. They often have full-time jobs. So the amount of time they spend with their children is, I think the statistics are, under 2 hours a day for mothers and a little under an hour per day for fathers. And what that means is that I think there's a level of guilt that never existed before. So one way of connecting with kids is to enter discussions and kind of allow that influence to happen, or handing over material goods instead of time.
Children often have a youthful idealism that can be welcome. What's so wrong with them influencing their parents' decisions?
I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with it. I think, in fact, you know, as you say, that there's kind of a lovely naivete, a lovely honesty that's not jaded, that can be very helpful, actually, in certain things. But I think one of the things that has happened over time is that the boundary between parent and child and the role of parent versus child and the responsibilities of parent versus child have gotten blurred. What that means is that, you know, for certain things like the Go Green campaigns that are going on, or no smoking campaigns, those are positive ways in which children can influence the world. But I think that there are lines that get crossed, because along with that kind of unjaded quality, there's a lack of wisdom, too.
Why are you so passionate on this point, Julie? Why is this of such interest to you?
You know, it's really of interest to me because what I and other parent educators see in today's world is a growing sense of entitlement amongst kids, that they should have the best designer clothes, that they should have the iPhone instead of just a regular cell phone. And along with that, I see the power of parents slipping away. And it's creating a generation of children who are entitled and yet don't feel typically safe in their environment. Because if the grown-ups don't have the decision-making power, if the grown-ups aren't standing up for what they believe in and, you know, making some of these more adult-like decisions, then the child really winds up with too much power. And that level of power, children inherently know that they're not capable of handling. And it creates a sense of insecurity in the world in which they live.
What is your guidance, Julie? How do you suggest a healthy way to include kids in adult decision-making?
You know, to tell you the truth, I think parents need to take more time with their kids. And that would reduce the level of guilt that a lot of parents feel in not being committed to playing baseball in the backyard, for example, and instead trying to get that quality time in over saying, who do you think I should vote for?
Julie, thanks for this conversation.
Oh, no problem. My pleasure.
Julie Ross is a parent and a family therapist at Parenting Horizons in New York. She's also the author of How to Hug a Porcupine, Negotiating the Prickly Points of the Tween Years. This is Weekend America. April snow in the plains, possible twisters in the Mississippi Valley. Here's more about the weekend weather with John Moe.
A lot of things in the air in Madison, Wisconsin. Rain, snow, stuff being blown around by heavy winds. Also, love. For frogs, anyway. The Arboretum has a listening session for the mating and territorial calls of frogs. You can even learn to perform your own frog calls. Downside, some frog keeps calling you up wanting to get together for coffee. Going to Killington, Vermont? Pack a raincoat and some irony. Rain, snow, 37 degrees for the Sunshine Daydream Festival. It's a weekend-long salute to the Grateful Dead, and more loosely, to doing that one dance where you spin around and flap your arms. The festival lasts 6 hours, or about a third as long as a Jerry Garcia guitar solo. Driggs, Idaho has a mountain, a bunch of cardboard, a sense of adventure, and not much regard for safety. Perfect for the Cardboard Box Derby. It's like the Kentucky Derby, but with cardboard boxes. Sun and 43 as folks plunge down a mountain in boxes festively decked out as dragons, race cars, and UFOs. Afterwards, the boxes are all festively decked out as garbage. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Turn up your speaker box because ballet is about to become an outcast next on Weekend America. Desiree Cooper is away this week. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to the weekend. Tonight, hip-hop meets high culture. Antoine Big Boy Patton of OutKast is joining the Atlanta Ballet Dance Troupe in a performance at the Fox Theater called Big. Reporter David Barris-Swain takes us to Atlanta now to look at preparations for Big's big night.
When I was a kid at Christmas time, my parents would drag me to the ballet. It turns out I wasn't the only one.
The first time I saw the ballet actually had to been fourth or fifth grade, maybe, and I think it was the Nutcracker.
That's Antoine Big Boy Patton. He's one half of the Atlanta-based hip-hop group OutKast, known for songs like Kryptonite and Bombs Over Baghdad. And now he's about to perform in his own ballet, not as a dancer, but as a musician in the show Big. The Atlanta Ballet had been looking for a way to showcase the talents of the growing hip-hop movement in Atlanta, so they reached out to Big Boy with the idea of merging ballet with hip-hop.
To put that to dance, to, you know, something that's as calm as a ballet, and you get different types of music for them to dance to, I think long as the beat's there and they can feel the music, that they're going to really dig it, man, because it's going to be electrifying. I can say that.
you like it or not. These two groups actually have a history of experimenting with their art. The Atlanta Ballet has done a dance adaptation of The Great Gatsby and another partnership with the Indigo Girls. And Big Boy has done his own form of musical experimentation. This song, Morris Brown, even uses a marching band. And everybody wanna know what's really going on. Is you on 3000 still making songs, so on and so on.
I can go on and on and on and on and on. Hell yes. I researched the whole hip-hop movement.
That's Lori Stallings, resident choreographer with the Atlanta Ballet. It's her job to express Big Boy's music through dance.
I wanted to educate myself and know the Dungeon family and what it was, and know who Killer Mike is, and of course, Def Records.
She not only learned about the characters in the hip-hop movement, she even learned every single song OutKast ever put out. But she still needed to decide the music. That would happen with a face-to-face meeting with the man himself.
So I brought my broke my iPod out, plugged it in, and she was just like, "So what songs do you think we, you know, you want to use?" I said, "Well, I'll flip through my catalog and we can kind of just thumb through it and see." So I just start playing songs, and she's like, "Oh my God, I want to use that one." I'm like, "Really?" And that was Kryptonite.
OutKast is just a huge engine, and it's a very good car. It's a really good car. It's a Rolls Royce. And I got to go inside of that world and discuss with Big what part of the engine we wanted to use.
She's like, you know, amazing, because she can feel it. And as soon as the music hits, she starts, you know, breaking out different dance moves and hand moves and making sound effects, and I was just like, okay, cool.
It will be based on what's happening around you. My guess is we won't dissect counts.
Here at one of the ballet's practice sessions for Big, a group of about 10 guys stand facing Lori. She gives verbal instructions and encouragement, and then she begins to move, sliding a Gene Kelly-like foot to the side and then suddenly twisting her palm and pushing it out and up. The guys mimic her actions perfectly, the spins, the slides, the kicks. But the weird thing is that there's no music in the rehearsal, just this.
Ta-ta, stay, break and fold, carve, carve, step first, shift and hoop, ha-ta-ta, and soft and finish.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Lori uses a lot of sound effects when she's teaching the choreography, too.
Christian Clark is one of the dancers of Big.
But it really, you know, it really, really helps to understand the movement when she does that. And I've sort of found that now all the dancers are doing it, even when we're not doing her choreography. We're all going, whoosh, making all these sounds. It's quite funny, actually. But it works.
But the dance is just one part of Big. One of the other big challenges is coordinating the schedules between the full season of the Atlanta Ballet and the jet-setting duties of a hip-hop celebrity. Then there's the stage production of Big with lights, video projections, and Big Boy singing live on stage with backup singers and a DJ, not to mention the dancers. A lot could go wrong, but Big Boy remains optimistic.
It's going to be very psyched out because you have two different lines, forms of art coming together to make one feature, you know what I mean? So you have like the daintiness, the elegance, and, you know, the sophistication of the ballet with the funk of me and my band, you know what I'm saying, and what we do. I can't wait to see it, you know. As long as nobody don't kick me in the face with a tutu shoes.
Big Boy really does hope that audiences leave entertained, but Lori Stallings also hopes they leave enlightened.
Those who are coming because they think they're there for hip-hop leave saying, "My goodness, I'm going to see every dance concert there is across the boards now." And those coming to see dance say, "My goodness, why have I not given hip-hop a chance?"
For Weekend America, I'm David Baraswain in Atlanta.
Big opened at the Atlanta Ballet last night, complete with a language advisory. It'll play through this weekend. And in case you can't make it to Atlanta to catch the show, organizers say if Big becomes a big hit, they'll consider taking it on the road. We've got a slideshow of Big Boy and that rehearsal. Hip hop over to weekendamerica.org. Now, here's a story for you. long, long ago, before the internet and music downloading, there were places that you could, get this, stay with me here, you could walk in and browse through record albums, actually touch them. They've called these buildings record stores, and they were places you could meet other music lovers, discover new bands.
I'm looking for a record for my daughter for her birthday. I just called to say I love you. Do you have it?
Yeah.
Great.
We have it.
Great. Can I have it then?
No. No, you can't.
Why not?
Well, it's sentimental, tacky crap. That's why not. Do we look like the kind of store that sells I just called to say I love you? Go to the mall.
Movie High Fidelity there. Next weekend, independent music stores around the country will celebrate Record Store Day. So, what are your record store memories? Tell us about your experiences of browsing the bins, discovering music, meeting human beings. Old school. To tell your story, you'll have to hook up to the interwebs. Come see us at weekendamerica.org. And that's another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. It has been lovely to have you with us. I'm Bill Radke. Desiree Cooper will be back with us next week. Remember, when you join us on the internets, you can also take us with you in our enhanced podcast. It's for free, and it's at weekendamerica.org. As Des would say, it's your weekend. Enjoy it.
News and financial information brought to you by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
It's the weekend. Perfect time for a chewy, melty grilled cheese sandwich. But it's all about the ingredients.
This guy is about to eat a sandwich with ground up light bulbs in it.
That is the sound of glass, ladies and gentlemen.
On the next Weekend America, we'll visit the Grilled Cheese Invitational. You'll look at your favorite comfort food in a whole new way. Join us.